Hello, you're watching Global Investor on Business Day TV. I'm Simon Brown. Dricus Kwambring from Capicraft joins me this evening to guide us through all the latest news on global markets. And later in the show, we'll be joined by Bradley Mitchell from Sasfin to discuss their global equity fund. All that way coming your way shortly. First, though, a quick look at what's been making headlines. In company news, Glencore posted a record 23% rise in core first half earnings and cut its debt to below target, but failed to increase its interim dividend as higher costs and lower prices for cobalt and other byproducts ate into the company's profits. The company did, however, say it will favour share buybacks over deal making, but shares in Glencore still fell post the results, partly due to worries about the impact of a trade war on Chinese demand. On the currency front, global markets trembled and fell to a one-month low as Turkey's worsening currency crisis persuaded investors to dump equities and emerging markets and flee to safer assets such as government bonds and the dollar. In the meantime, Turkey's central bank has pledged to provide liquidity and cut reserve requirements for Turkish banks, but its meltdown still continued to rattle global markets. And Elon Musk said in a post on Twitter that he is considering taking Tesla private at $420 per share, sending the company's stock skyrocketing. But Tesla's board says that it has not yet received a detailed financing plan from Musk and is seeking more information about how he would take the electric car maker private. He has more on that.
Tesla chief executive Elon Musk is considering taking his company off the market. Musk wrote in a post on Twitter, "Am considering taking Tesla private at $420. Funding secured." It wasn't clear if Musk was serious, as he has a history of erratic tweets. Tesla did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Musk owns nearly 20% of the company. Its shares shot up to over $360 on his tweet. Tesla had a market value of $58 billion as of Monday's close. A buyout proposed by Musk would represent a 20% premium and value the electric automaker at about $72 billion, said our financial group chief investment officer Gene Goldman.
Going private allows company management to focus on long-term growth targets and growth opportunities without worrying about short-term profit impacts. Also, there's less scrutiny. You think about it, you know, fewer public shareholders to take an eye watching company, also less activist shareholders. I saw a study a few years ago from McKinsey and Company that talked about private company boards versus public company boards. Private company boards in this study are more nimble, are able to take advantage of more opportunities. Plus, you know, public traded company boards seem to be more focused on budgetary controls as opposed to growth opportunities. So we'll see what happens.
Separately, the Financial Times reported that Saudi Arabia's sovereign wealth fund has built a stake in Tesla of between 3 and 5%.
Joined now by Dricus Kwambring from Capicraft. Dricus, thanks. I want to quickly touch on the Glencore story. Not Glencore itself, but I read that and I think Glencore's South African. Of course it's not. It's global. It's JSE listed, but it's dual listed. How do you look at stocks like that? British American Tobacco would fall into that one. BHP another. Do you look at them as global? Do you invest them in ZAR, in dollar? And how do you play that?
Well, in construction portfolio, I like to look at risk factors, firstly. So when breaking up, you know, stocks into geopolitical spheres, I tend to look at emerging markets and developed markets. And commodity producers would fall mostly into the emerging market one. So I'm inclined to buy it locally because locally it's my emerging market. As being an emerging market, I'd buy it in local portfolios. And offshore, for diversification sakes, I tend to focus on other risk factors, which would include big industrial or financial multi-listed or multinational companies. Not the likes of Xstrata.
Not the likes of Xstrata. You touched on sort of the emerging versus developed. We've seen today culminating in what's been a couple of weeks of a tough space for emerging markets. And my question I was going to put to you is you know, do you look at these emerging markets as offshore? You're saying that to you, it's not so much an offshore czar split. Yeah. To you, it's emerging versus developed, and Turkey, if you're there at all, would fall into that emerging equation.
Absolutely. So that's generally what we do is local portfolio. I tend to focus on emerging market stocks, and it doesn't make sense when an investor diversifies offshore to add even more emerging market risk exposure when you know, already
you've got so much already.
You know, so I'm inclined to use the local portfolio to buy double listed entities that also has exposure to Eastern Europe or to China, which we do have a lot of, especially in the property space. We have a few that's exposed to Eastern Europe or Southern Europe and so forth. So we use the local portfolio for that. But when, you know, you've got an emerging market stock and it's offshore listed and it makes sense from a bottom up perspective, you shouldn't, you know, fall into that hard and fast rule. Don't buy emerging market. No, you have to be flexible around that. And firstly, it's about a bottom up story, and we put up with these risk factors from a top down perspective. But it's more about us about the bottom up story of the company.
And that's a good point. If the company is of quality, if the earnings are of quality, if the growth prospects are real, if the risks are what you consider to be fair enough for the price that you're paying, and it happens to be emerging market, well, then so be it. You don't want to just have a hard line in the sand that says not at all. If you find that gem and it's got real prospects, then
and here's the thing. If it's really a gem and if you're buying it with a decent margin of safety, then you should be able to stomach an emerging market crisis and keep holding that right through the emerging market crisis, come out the other side of the crisis stronger, you know, than you would have. So generally when clients, you know, the same reasoning, when clients call me and they say that, listen, we're a bit scared of a bear market, and you know, we've read this article or that article and there's a recession on the loom. So generally the answer would be, go through your portfolio. If at least 80% of the portfolio you're not willing to hold through a recession, you know, get rid of those and limit it to about a 20% more speculative side to your portfolio that you are betting on, you know, a continued bull market or a specific case. But 80% of our portfolio should be not recession-proof, but you're willing to sit with it through even a 1930s type depression.
Yeah, I take your point. Not recession-proof, but recession-surviving.
Surviving, yeah.
And coming out the other side, because recessions are as sure as day will follow night. Exactly. And it almost seems that emerging market crises, so if we go back to the crisis of 10 years ago, that originated in the States. 20 years ago, 98, was emerging markets, Asian tigers, Russia. Mm. And we're seeing a bit of contagion. There was some pressure on Italian bonds today. Whether that was directly related, who knows? Are you taking this seriously? Are you, worried about it spreading wider? Or are you taking a view, perhaps, that is, you know, we own quality. You talked about your 80%. You're happy if this is a big event that we're going to be talking about for decades to come. Portfolio needs to be positioned for anything.
At the risk of sounding like an EU bureaucrat, you know, this is not Greece. Turkey is not Greece. There's big difference. Greece was a government debt problem.
Yeah.
So the Turkey government debt is quite low. It's about 30% of GDP. It's going to get more expensive funding that, because most of that debt or a big portion of that debt is externally funded. It's listed in its euro bonds. So as the currency depreciates, your commitments, your coupons that you have to pay on that gets more expensive. The real problem in Turkey is not government debt. It's firstly, before we get into what Erdogan has done, is sounds like a character from Middle Earth, you know, from the Erdogan. But he's before we get into what he did is the low interest rates in the euro area has led to a lot of European countries on the periphery of the European nations borrowing in euros a lot of debt, corporates, and especially the banks, and especially the Turkish banks. So about 50% of total Turkey debt, 50% of that is externally funded or is listed or in a foreign country, mostly euros. So that makes a big difference when the currency devalues. It didn't make a big difference up until about 2 years ago when you got an acceleration in inflation in Turkey. And on top of that, you had a breakaway from prudent monetary management, where inflation was trending to double figures and they just sat back and did nothing interest rate wise. And I think that's the biggest difference between what we do locally in SA and what's happened in Turkey. The biggest difference, there's a lot of similarities, especially all the stuff that led up to this. But the big difference is the monetary management of the economy. We are very prudent, the SA Reserve Bank, and it's independent, while about 2 years ago, you know, the the Turkish central bank lost all its independence, and that is the cause of the crisis at the moment. There's a lot of other factors that lead up to that, but that's the major point that the
central bank independence. No, yeah. It's a good point, and we still have it. All we've been through, we still have a great central bank. Let's go to Elon Musk and Tesla and his tweet delisting at $420. I mean, the gents are cowboy. His cars are great by all accounts. He's going to Mars. Sounds like fun, etc., etc. But we were saying before we came on. I mean, not with my capital. This is not how you run a company. You don't do important, massively important statements on Twitter. I mean, he's going to get SEC and lawsuits left, right, and center.
Yeah, and it seems to me he's got a bit of a childish, cowboyish behavior with regards to and a rivalry with the short side of the market with hedge funds. You know, he just sent David Arnon, who's short the company, a parcel of shorts, you know, as a joke. That's funny for the moment, but it shows a bit of his, let's call it, childish arrogance around it, and a lack of respect for shareholders and for the investment community. So I'm trying to understand why a lot of people are still buying Tesla shares, apart from the hype or the, you know, a lot of industries change the face of, you know, of that industry and of the life as we know it. Think about the dot-com boom that we had in 2000 and from 1998 to 2002, and that ended badly for shareholders. Yet it created a lot of value for consumers. So, you know, the two need not be, you know, in the same Venn diagram.
Now, first mover is not always the best place to be. So let's go to what was a second mover company, PepsiCo. CEO quits, Andrea Noya, been there since October 2006. I know you're not a fan. You've been focusing on mononationals, you say. Mm. This is perhaps the epitome of multinationals. Mm. But she's done a brilliant job with a company that was always second run to Coca-Cola. She moved into health snacks. She moved into snacks then. Health snacks and water, and she certainly has changed that company to,
absolutely,
when I think of the two, to me Pepsi would come out perhaps as a preferred.
And one of the reasons why this works with companies like Pepsi is if you think about a company like Anheuser-Busch, AB InBev, these companies in the FMCG market, they are distribution companies, and they buy brands. And this can be incremental. They buy brands for whatever price. They're not really interested always in the distribution capabilities of the firm that they're acquiring. They're interested in the brands. So they're buying the brands, and they're hinging that onto their distribution platform. That's what AB InBev has done, and that's what PepsiCo has done. You know, it was a beverages company, and they've bought other brands and just distributed through that network quite brilliantly, and that's actually the competitive advantage of these firms, and it's not going to go away. You just need the right person to install the right culture, which they did, and just realizing this competitive advantage, you know, leveraging it.
Yeah, SAB Millet, when I bought it in the 90s, I bought them for their trucks, not their beer.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because they could get their beer absolutely anywhere. Absolutely. You never walked into a pub and didn't have an SAB product.
Absolutely.
And it was that distribution. We're going for a short break. When we come back, we'll take a look at Sasfin's Global Equity Fund with Bradley Mitchell. Stay tuned. Welcome back. You're watching Global Investor. Still with me in studio, Trikas Kronbeck, and joining us to discuss Sasfin's Global Equity Fund, Bradley Mitchell. Bradley, thanks for joining us. I want to touch on a relatively new fund. I want to come to some nuts and bolts around it.
Yes.
I want to first get a sense of the theme and the thinking around it, bottom up versus top down. Certainly, you've got a lot of consumer discretionary. You've the Apples and the Facebooks, which are often in number one and two, and maybe a Microsoft thrown in, sort of lacking in that space. Give us some of the thinking of the philosophy behind the fund.
So I think the core underlying philosophy, as we've mentioned before, is that there is a top-down thematic approach to it. We are long-term investors by nature, but at the same sense, we want to take high conviction bets in terms of stock-specific exposure. So this is a 30-stock type portfolio. And the reason for that is we want to be able to know the companies that we invest in extremely well. So relative to the benchmark, you're going to get a high level of stock relative, tracking error. But what we do look at it from both a thematic point of view and from a sector exposure point of view is that we position ourselves from that way to ensure that the diversification both by geography, region, currency is managed sectorally, and then we dig into the quality of the companies underpinning in order to get the best possible return that we can. Having said that, I think the one thing you mentioned is perhaps there's a bit of a negative return at the moment, and the fund is young. So it's a combination of that. I mean, a short period of time building up assets initially, there is that drag in the beginning. So yeah. I think it's unfair to start to measure that until it's got at least a 3 to 5 year sort of track record. What I mean by that is your TER, total expense ratio, as they call it, is based on a 12-month average assets over a time period. So when you're ramping up your assets at the beginning, you've got this big drag of low assets at the beginning. So any fixed cost that is used to the admin fees and so on the fund have a big impact. We're at a level now at about $22.5 million in the fund, where once that gets into the sort of base in the next sort of 6 to 12 months, then you'll see a big ratcheting down in the total expense ratio.
Do you have a target for the total expense ratio?
We do. So there's two basic share classes, one for retailers and one for institutional. On the global side, the A class has got a 1.45 targeted soft cap, and the B class has got a 125 targeted soft cap.
Okay. Because I noticed the high number, and I thought that, because the fund's not even yet a year old. It'll be a year in October.
Exactly.
Let's delve into, you talk around top-down and then finding, we're seeing the current emerging market craziness happening. The comment that you make is you want to sort of be invested on major global equity exchanges.
Correct.
If I look at your look-through principle on revenue, There's a bit in Asia, China, we can debate whether it's emerging market or not.
Yes.
But you certainly seem to be skewed towards developed markets rather than EMs.
We are, particularly if you look at it from the point in terms of where the stocks are actually listed. So then the exposure looks a lot worse. But it's important, especially when you're looking down to the underlying companies, to understand where the revenue is being generated. At this point in time, you've still got a fairly strong U.S. market with strong employment numbers, strong growth still coming through. Well, it's fairly low, but in comparison and the high base that is coming off of it, it's still quite strong. And therefore, we don't feel that the developed market exposure is something to throw out yet. You will notice, however, that the European exposure on a look-through principle, both Europe and if you bring in the UK obviously much smaller, and for obvious reasons in terms of the enormous amount of uncertainty still surrounding Brexit and the details that has to be worked through and whether it's going to happen or not and the impact it's going to have. But even on the European front, so the whole currency blowout that we've seen, the impact that has on Europe is another reason why we are still a little bit cautious in terms of our particularly European bank exposure. We have no European bank exposure as an example.
Yeah, Europe, we were talking, a lot of the Turkish banks and the like have got their debt in EU, but that has implications flowing both ways. Right. Now, certainly we didn't see the euro getting slaughtered today like we did the EM currencies.
But you saw the banking stocks getting slaughtered.
You saw the banking stocks under
pressure. Yeah, the most prominent being BNP Paribas and what's the other Spanish bank? Can't pronounce the name even. SocGen, I think, also eats quite lossy. So a lot of your more Latin banks has got exposure to Eastern Europe. I think that a lot of them have fallen about from 5% to about 15% in the last few days. And I don't think it's over necessarily. I think there's some fallout to come. I think the total exposure to Turkish debt is about 0.5%. But 0.5% for a leveraged banking sector is a lot. There's a big leverage bank, loan to equity ratio. So 0.5%, if you are capitalized at 15%, 0.5 or 15%, that's a lot.
To count. My sense is, Stuart, coming back to you, you talk about the US, and if we go back 10 years and look how the developed economies have handled that financial crisis, the US was out of the gates in a hurry. Europe came, it's kind of like they went, no disrespect, a siesta first in the US, 45% look-through exposure in the US, but this is the strong economy. We've got S&P probably on track for beating first quarter, and that was the best since 2010. Short talk GDP, some one-offs in there, but it is an economy that is firing on all cylinders. Yeah. And right now, in developed marketing space, is where to be.
Yeah, correct. And also, you know, relative to the benchmark, which is the MSCI Morgan Stanley Composite Index All Country World, mm-hmm. which has that emerging market exposure, as I was mentioning mm-hmm. earlier just offline, is your China and Asian exposure is actually not underweight relative to your benchmark. So again, when you look at it from a regional point of view in terms of diversification, you don't want to take an oversized bet in an area where there can be a high level of potential risk still, a certain level of uncertainty in terms of the governance and regulation and so on, yeah. on a particular impact as well.
Your biggest sector, sorry, Drikas, you want to jump in?
Sorry.
Your biggest sector, consumer discretionary, then financials, then IT.
Yes.
IT and financials are usually there when I look at funds. IT often in front. Consumer discretionary smacks to me what you were saying a moment ago. That this is almost the all-weather type of thing. Drikas was saying, as sure as a recession is coming. When?
Yes.
Don't know. Is it coming? Absolutely it is. And the consumer discretionary strikes me as those sort of companies that if you get them at the right valuations and you get the right quality companies, they almost all weather, and yes, recession will hurt, but they're going to come out the other side, and they're probably going to eat a few competitors along the way. And they almost true bottom draw stock.
I think a lot of them also speak to a strong thematic in terms of strong branding and their control over the market in which they operate. And I don't mean just a market in terms of a region, but I mean a market in terms of the type of industry. So some of the companies, take like an Estee Lauder, which unfortunately is one that, tends to get away from you, and you always look at it, the valuation looks a bit expensive. I don't wear makeup, and maybe I should. But that is one where the brand quality is so strong. That is one that you can hold in the bottom drawer and be quite confident. Another one is, Louis Vuitton, Moët Hennessy. So we have that in the consumer discretion side. In contrast to that, you've got a consumer staple, you've got something like a Diageo, which contrasts the alcoholic side of LVMH quite nicely. And I think the combination of those two is also quite a nice differentiator and diversification to the likes of an Anheuser-Busch, for example.
Yeah. Drikas, this is what you're talking about, that 80% of your portfolio, I suppose people will say it's boring. It can be, although they can do spectacular stuff. But it's that nice base pin that you put into
it. 80% of the portfolio being your core and one that you wouldn't mind owning through a recession doesn't mean that you have to own a defensive company.
Yes.
A lot of the companies that you've mentioned is defensive companies. Doesn't mean that the top line is defensive. Is that you trust the management and you trust the economics of the business longer term that you've bought it at a low enough price. It doesn't need to be an absolute bargain, but a low enough price that you're still going to see at the other side of the recession, 10 years on, 5 years on even, that you're going to see decent long-term returns. And that's what it's about. At the end of the day, quality is defined wrongly by a lot of people. Quality is defined as defensive. No, that's not what quality means. Quality means the ability of the company to generate returns on capital higher than the cost of capital. And that's what it's all about.
I like that. I want to go to your biggest holding, Berkshire Hathaway, in some senses, Berkshire Hathaway is easy. There's a book value, and that Berkshire is a buyer
below intrinsic value, whatever he defines that to be.
In there, you've got some Coke, you've got some Amex and others, but you've also got a fairly diverse portfolio. Talk me, aside from obviously the Warren Buffett part of the story and the trips to Omaha, the Berkshire story for you.
So I think you actually touched the nail on the head there in terms of the diversification. I mean, that's one of the sort of key factors as to why you consider Berkshire as one of those core holdings in a portfolio. We're talking about a concentrated portfolio, but Berkshire, you have this perception that it's a concentrated holding, but in actual fact, it's got diverse exposure to sectors of the market, which you can't easily get access to, and it's got it at really great intrinsic values in the past. That's one of the key factors about them, is the simplicity in terms of how he acquires businesses, when he acquires them, being patient in terms of getting them at the right price. We're talking about quality. We have the same philosophy in terms of, it's not just about having confidence in terms of the earnings growth or the earnings profile or being able to earn a return in excess of your working weighted average capital, cost of capital, but it's also in terms of having that, confidence in that the earnings is going to come through. And, that's one of the sort of criteria that you will sort of look at. I think the other thing, we've seen those results. This is a large company. To generate revenue, its last numbers, 19% year on year, and net income growth in excess of 180%. Granted, the one thing you have to take into consideration is, you know, the important part is the new accounting principles that came in.
Sure, sure.
But having said that, I mean, you know, Warren himself stated how he hates that and, you know, trying to re-emphasize the point. I love the fact that he reports on a Friday afternoon after the markets, giving the market time to absorb all the information and work through it and actually realize, okay, this time round we've got a positive kicker again in terms of that market to market on the investment holdings. But unfortunately, it can have a quick swing the other day, just depending on the day in which you measure it.
Which you actually report. And he's got great stuff. I mean, Geico and almost a bellwether for the U.S. economy. We've got about half a minute to go. He's got a giant cash pile, which, frankly, he struggles to spend. He talks about an elephant gun. I think he now needs bigger than an elephant gun. Does that create a bit of a drag, or are you comfortable with that?
I think we're comfortable with that in terms of knowing, and this is the point about it, he's got a good track record in terms of being patient about acquiring the businesses at the right value.
He's waiting for a recession.
Absolutely. We saw that in 2008.
Exactly.
So sitting, I mean, you know he's more comfortable with having that level closer to $20 billion. It's currently sitting at north of 111. So I think when the time is right, maybe the other talk, the one disappointing part that came out that everybody was looking for was obviously the talk about share buybacks and returning some cash to shareholders, which there was almost no mention of. But hopefully that will, you know, it's one other option that he can implement. But again, he's not willing to do that unless it's close to intrinsic value.
But two great points, patience, which is important, and recessions. They will come and then he will jump in them. That's the show for this week. My thanks to our guests. Dricus Kronbrink from Capri Craft, Bradley Mitchell, fund manager at Susfin. Thank you very much for watching. I'll catch you same time, same place next week. Have a good evening.